All right. Well, thanks for coming this morning to Nada Amin's talk. Nada is interviewing here for the next couple of days as a researcher. Nada's is Dr. Nada Amin from EPFL. She defended her thesis in December right here, and has think is fairly well known to me several of us here. Nada has visited here in the past and has written papers with Roostern and worked with others in the room as well. She's done some really impressive work in her PhD thesis. She's formalized a core of Scala in a calculus called a DOT, a dependent object types. And I just heard this morning that the new version of the Scala compiler is going to be based on her calculus and it's called Dotty. She's also done very impressive and well-publicized work recently on finding some unsoundnesses in the Java type system. And I think she'll also tell us in this talk about doing some staged metaprogramming in Scala. So it's all very exciting work, and I'm super happy to have Nada here over the next couple of days, and I hope you'll enjoy her visit too. Welcome, Nada.
Thank you, Nick. So type, safety net, and Spring Boot. I'll start with some context around Scala. So Scala is a programming language that is popular in industry. And one reason is that it aims to be a scalable language in the sense that it tries to make it easy to evolve from small scripts to large systems. And the type system plays an important role in this scalability. And in this talk, we'll ask two questions. First, what about type safety? How can we ensure sound foundations for practical languages like Scala? And second, what about performance? How can we make high-level languages like Scala usable for performance-critical software? And finally, we'll try to combine safety and beyond functional correctness and performance. So on to safety net. So Scala is a language that fuses concepts from functional programming and object-oriented programming. And even in the type system, it has some types that we could classify along one dimension of modular and the other dimension of functional. So for the modular types, Scala has named types, compound types, where you actually put together two types and you get the combination of functionality, and refined type, where you start with a type and add more methods. And on the functional side, you get the usual parameterized type, existential type, and higher kind of type. Now, one question is, can we reduce the functional to the modular? And one idea would be that we change from type parameter to type member. So for example, the list class, instead of having a type parameter LM, would have a type member LM. And then parameterized type becomes a refined type where we instantiate the type LM with an actual type definition. And then for existential types and higher kind of types, this sort of reduction is not quite precise. But even if we go beyond this, one issue is that if we consider just the modular set, there is a missing safety net in the sense that we don't know if we have sound foundations for such a set of types. And on the functional side, I mean, there have been some nice foundational work on making sure the building blocks were guaranteed type safety, but for the modular side, not as much. And if we look at Scala, in fact, during the course of this work, we found several examples of unsoundness, and this is one of them. The idea here is that we can have an identity function between that goes from any to nothing, which is basically means we can collapse the whole subtyping lattice from the top to the bottom. And we do this through a path-dependent type here where the path is P, and it has bad bounds in the sense that we can define a type member where the lower bound is top and the upper bound is nothing. And so through this path-dependent type, we can collapse the lattice. But actually here, we're not even providing a real path, we're just providing null, so we're bypassing any checks. And this sort of unsoundness arises from a combination of features, like these path-dependent types with null values and things like this. And maybe in the context of Scala, it wasn't so surprising that we had such issues. But we also discovered similar issues in Java, and this is this example is due to raw state. And here the idea is that Java, even though it doesn't have path dependent types, it also has a way.
Sorry, I don't really know path dependent types.
Yeah.
Can you just tell me what
yeah,
they
I'll
are?
Come back to them in a bit.
Okay.
But
the question on the previous slide is,
yeah.
What is the unsoundness here? Is it that nothing is expected to be uninhabited?
Yeah, nothing is expected to be uninhabited. And really, because we go from any to nothing, that means we can also go from string to int.
Sure,
and things
sure.
Like this. But the idea of path-dependent types is that you have you have some sort of object here, A, and it has a type L, so you can reference you can select the type L as a type from the object. So there's a dependency between this A and the L. But I'll come back to these type members in a bit. But Java doesn't even have these path-dependent types, and we can create the issue. And here, this curse is also an identity function that changes any type T to any type U. And the way it does this is that basically through these sort of wildcards, we get some implicit subtyping assumptions added. And here we're adding something that basically collapses from the lattice from T to U. And we do this because we're using null as a value, so we're sort of not providing any object to witness the subtyping constraint. And Java has actually many subsets of Java have been proved sound mechanically and theorized. It's just that these features were never put together, null and these other features in the type. So, okay, why do foundations matter? Well, first, they help ensure properties such as type soundness, but of course, working bottom up from subsets of the language, it's not enough. We have to put everything together. But they allow an exploration of the landscape when you try to prove type soundness that serves as a feedback loop for language design. And they help detect hidden connections between language features. So in the previous example, we saw a hidden connection between null and these sort of subtyping constraints. And one question is, why not pick existing foundations? Where here, for the work in Scala, we're trying to find a new foundation based on these ideas of path-dependent types and type members and as a way to build everything up from there. And so if we pick existing foundations, it would lead to variants of existing languages, and it would not capture the features we're interested in. One way to think of it is that foundations are formative. By looking at new foundations, we get new insights. And so our goal here is to find a minimal theory that can model type parameterization, modules, objects, and classes, and subtyping. And by minimal, we mean that we do not deal with code-sharing mechanisms like inheritance. So we really are focused on typing and subtyping and sort of the type aspects. And so to get back to the core language features that we want to model, and this is where I'll expand path-dependent types in more detail. So here we have a trait, and you can think of it as just this interface or signature for this example, a trait keys, which has a type member key and a method member, which takes a data string and returns this key, this reference to this type member. And we can implement such a signature with this object, hash keys, where we say that the type member key is equal to int. And then for key, we just provide a definition in terms of the hash code. And then when we use this keys interface, we can have this k.key, which refers to the actual key type member of this of this interface keys. So here it's left abstract, but I mean, if key was a hash keys, then this type member would be an int. We might know it or we might not know it. And so this is the interplay between type members and path-dependent types. And with this, we can encode a lot of things, like including this sort of type parameters that we saw before.
OK, so this sort of subsumes generics, because
so,
you have
yeah.
the ability to reference.
Yeah, so you would transform a generic into a type member.
Right.
But then for generics, there is also some sort of kind checking.
Right.
And the kind checking part is not quite subsumed. So higher kind of types are not exactly fitting in.
And what about type constraints? They're part of the interface? Or the
yeah,
traits?
So type constraints are part of the interface in the sense that here I can, when I specify a type member, I can give a lower bound and an upper bound type.
I see. Okay.
So, So this is basically, this is what we did, this dot calculus, dependent object types, as a sound foundation for practical languages like Scala. And the idea here is that we build everything from these building blocks of type members, path-dependent types, and also adding subtyping ladders. So when we explored the landscape bottom-up, one way to think of it is that we start with system F sub, and then on the one hand, we add these type members and path-dependent types. And then by doing this, we also kind of unify quantification over types and quantification over terms from system F sub. And then on the other hand, we add also lower bounds in addition to upper bounds. So in system F sub, you have this upper bounded quantification, but in our case, you can specify both a lower bound and an upper bound, which is also why we also get into trouble with these contradictory bounds. So in terms of the road to dot, the going bottom up, what we do is that we add, from system F sub, we add lower bound for translucency. And then we use these type members and selections, adding them and unifying the calculus a little bit. Then we add the subtyping lattice by adding intersection and union types. Then we add records. And then finally, recursion over self to get full objects. And the main thing I will focus later on is on how to deal with bad bounds, which was one reason we had the unsoundness in Scala. Apart from this, there were also other challenging steps, which is how to deal with substitution, especially substitution of these values that can now have type members, and also how to deal with cycles in the proofs when you add recursive self types. Okay, so in terms of impact on practice, particularly Scala and Dotti, which is the new compiler for Scala. So the new compiler for Scala uses a core type system based on dot, and that has enabled simplifications. And so this is the first point. And then another thing is that the theory helps cautiously lift ad hoc restrictions in the sense that, for example, some features might be more powerful in the theory than in practice, where they're more ad hoc. So one case is recursive structural types. And then as I show with the unsoundness example, so here the theory plays a role in characterizing such soundness issues and proposing fixes that are not just ad hoc but more principled. And here what we have is that as a principle, we have that every prefix p of a type selection p dot a must be a computed value, meaning it must not be lazy. And in particular, it must not be null. So it must be some concrete object. And that comes directly from the theory. Okay, so just to give a quick idea of the syntax, so the term language is quite usual. You have these new object expressions, where you have a self and then a set of declarations, and these declarations can be either the usual method members, or what is new here is that you can have type members, and here we just allow aliases when you create an object, and then on the type side. You have the similarly you have the type member types and method member types, and while methods they just get eliminated as usual as method applications, but for these type members they get eliminated as the type level through these path dependent types or type selections. And if we look more closely at the types, then we have the usual things. The usual constructs for a subtyping lattice, so intersection, union, and then top, bottom. And then these structural member types, path-dependent types, and recursive types. And these are the type building blocks from which we want to build everything.
The path is always at the point. X.L, you can't have a longer path.
Yeah, that's a good question. So in Scala, you can have a chain of immutable field selections. Here, we just restrict it to a variable. It makes the theory a little bit easier. I mean, there's work now in terms of extending the theory to paths. It looks feasible. I mean, in some sense, you can always assign a longer thing to a variable and then use that in your types. And then the other thing to note is that you have some dependencies between the types and the variables. So here, through these path-dependent types, so here, the return type may depend on the parameter variable. And here the type may depend on the self. Okay, and so with this, we can model type parameters, variants, nominal typing, generative modules, self-types, and ADTs in simple classes. And the way we model nominal typing is by using this is the lower bound and upper bound, and for example, by setting the upper bound to bottom, we make the type opaque. And I'll show an example here. So this is the semantic intuition for path-dependent types. If you have a variable x, where the type member L has a lower bound of S and an upper bound of U, then intuitively this is what you want. You want to say that S is a subtype of X dot L and it's a subtype of U. And if we go back to the example with keys, here if I have hash keys, I can abstract it in different ways. So I can say, well, keys has a type key and this key is completely abstract. So lower bound of bottom, upper bound of top. I can say, well, the type key is actually an alias for int that's making it completely transparent, or I can make it just upper bounded or just lower bounded. And depending on what I choose, some constraints are available or not. So if I have one, I know it's an int. So I know that int is a subtype of lower bounded dot key because of this part. And so this holds, but it wouldn't hold to say one I cannot type one as upper bounded dot key. But on the other side, I can type upper bounded dot key A as int because I know this part. I know that upper bounded dot key is a subtype of int. So basically, by using this rule, we can reason about what constraints are available in the system.
This is maybe a naive question, but I don't have a good intuition for where the kind of programming patterns that really rely on lower bounds.
Yeah, so here, lower bound is a way to. By putting a lower bound of bottom, you're making your type abstract, so you're preserving your abstraction in some
lower
sense.
Lower bounds of bottom seem to be like the sort of degenerate case, right? Like typically, if you just have an upper bound, then implicitly your lower bound is bottom, right?
Yeah.
But what's an example of a non-bottom lower bound that's useful?
That's useful. So in general, it's basically if you want to partially hide some information from your type. So say as an upper bound, you give the functionality that you want people to be able to use from your type. And then as an upper bound, you give the functionality that you want to reveal. And maybe there are some things you don't want to reveal completely. So here we're just showing the extreme case of like completely abstract, completely transparent. But in general, say if you have more structure in your type, so if you have a record type, then you might want to reveal some fields but not others. Basically, it's also a way to say if instead of making.
I can do that with an upper bound, right? I want to reveal that this thing is at least a point, so it may in fact be a colored point. But then you
would want maybe the lower bound allows you to say. So the upper bound gives you the maximum, and the lower bound gives you like, okay, well, it can have these extra things. So you're right. It's in some sense, usually you either make it completely abstract or you make it an alias. But here you allow this sort of even more fine-grained translucency where you reveal certain things.
And Scala programmers use both. Existing Scala supports both, or is this?
Yeah. So you can use both. Okay. So you can specify both an upper bound and a lower bound. I would say these are usually the way people use these things. So completely transparent, abstract, or just upper bounded and just lower bounded. Lower bounded also works well for things that are usually in contravariant positions and things like this.
Yes.
So. But yeah, you can also combine these two bounds. Okay, so one trouble then that we can already see from this rule is that if the user specifies this type member definition, so say this type member T, has a lower bound of S and an upper bound of U. And so by transitivity, S is a subtype of U because T is a supertype of S and a subtype of U, and by transitivity over the type member. And so this is a bit surprising because the user could specify whatever he wanted for S and U. So what if the bounds are nonsensical? What if the lower bound is top and the upper bound is bottom? Well, then we basically collapse the subtyping lattice to a point, and that's what happened in the unsound example. So how do we deal with this? That's the first challenge. And one question is, can we exclude these bad bounds statically? Well, the problem is that they might arise through intersection types. Because if you have a path P that is such an intersection type, then you can choose to use either the bound from here or the bound from there. So you can also create a bad bound, a sort of bad derivation like this. And the problem is that you cannot rule these out all statically from the program, because these bounds become more precise as the program executes. And so you might have bad bounds that occur after a while. So in general, you have this tension between narrowing and transitivity, where for narrowing, if you get more information about your context, you still want to be able to derive the same judgment. But for transitivity, you want to be able to basically uncollapse these things so that you can structurally, basically you want to push back transitivity one step so you can compare types structurally. And the second trouble, which is also known in the ML module literature, is that if you have abstraction, there's a bit of tension with preservation. And in particular here, we can have this brand unpack brand pack, where we reduce the brand pack to just 7. It's just the identity function. But now this actually doesn't type checks, because here we have an int, but we've made the type brand abstract, so we don't know anything about the type hidden in the abstraction. And to solve both of these problems, what we do is that we actually have a distinction between concrete and abstract variables. So the idea is in the actual subtyping relation, when we're actually considering reduction systems, we also include the store. And for variables that refers to the store, we actually use the exact type member from the object instead of the more abstract one from gamma. And by using this, then this problem here completely disappears, because when we're reducing, that means that brand is now concrete, so we know exactly the type hidden. And this also helps solve the first problem, because for pushing back transitivity, we know we only need to do it in a context with no abstract types, where we have a fully concrete context. Okay, so I'm not going into the whole details here, but I'm.
Mm-hmm. I understand you always go completely concrete in your type theory.
So the theory is abstract for abstract thing. I mean, the theory is not concrete when you start a program, when everything is abstract.
Right.
But as you reduce for things that are in the store, you go concrete. And but then you have to show that you're right. So the way to think of it is that when you're in a concrete, I mean, when things are in the store, then you are breaking abstraction boundaries. But it doesn't affect the abstraction boundaries in the original program.
So like in the brand example,
mm-hmm.
Instead of like keeping the type of 7 more precise to the abstract type, you
mm-hmm.
actually concretize the brand variable to
no longer
have a hidden type.
Yeah, but if you wrote this in a program, that would still be not valid, because at this point, brand would be abstract. But when you are reducing your program, so as a proof device, when you're during reduction, you can choose to, or evaluation if you're using a big step.
Or extra syntax elements that are not available to the user programmer.
Yeah.
Right. So
yeah.
So what do you do, like a special reduction step or special?
No, so the way.
Syntax or?
So the way to think about it is.
Somewhere the brand variable must be.
Yeah.
Concretized.
So, yeah,
through
so
your reduction.
Yeah, so here.
Valid transformation as a user, right?
Yeah, you're right. So
right.
So even as a proof, we have to actually relate those two things, right? We have to make sure that the concrete reduction is consistent with the abstract reduction, and it can choose to allow more relationships. But it has to at least be consistent with the other one.
Well, it's a common technique, right?
Yeah.
To avoid like intermediate untypeable programs, to kind of extend.
Yeah, to make it more relaxed.
A bit,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So here,
I just
even
want to make sure I
yeah,
I
even understand. Even syntactically, we do it here by, you know, for concrete variable we use we use y's usually, and for abstract variables we use.
And
z.
Y's are not.
And X is for both, so X is for both, but yeah.
Right.
But basically, say for example, the self types, they're always Z's, right? So these are usually abstract, and this, yeah.
Right.
the stores are concrete and so on. So you're right, I don't realize if it's quite common, but it's true that in general you do some sort of relaxation, but I think this idea to distinguish between concrete and abstract variables, I hadn't really seen it elsewhere in that shape.
I haven't seen that particular form, mm-hmm. but yeah. I mean, sometimes there's more systems where there's like, intermediate reduction steps are not typable, and then for the soundness proof, you extend the type
yeah.
system or usually the syntactical elements, so you keep somehow
yeah.
track that you were
yeah.
there.
Yeah, so here conceptually, all we're doing is breaking abstraction boundaries for concrete things. And it makes sense because for the actual concrete methods, when you do inlining, you are in some sense actually, you know, like looking inside the implementation. So why not for the type as well?
Right.
Yeah.
So a related question. Are you familiar with this work by Greg Morissette, Dan Grossman, and Steve Stanswick? It's a syntactic type abstraction with these colored brackets, a way of. So I think the point there is
mm-hmm.
that. If you want to use your calculus to show that type abstraction on the source program actually enforces information hiding
okay.
On the operational semantics of your language, then I think this way of breaking abstraction in the operational semantics will prevent you from doing that, right? If I understood correctly, because you don't have a way in the operational semantics to speak about some type always being treated abstractly, because once it goes into the store, it's always concrete.
So I guess the way you would have to do it is to show that, so when it goes into the store, it's concrete, but then it's still consistent with the abstract view, right? So you're right, it's with this sort of soundness proof, you don't automatically get that you're preserving the abstraction barriers.
So for example, if I wanted to show that at my program, if I take two runs of my program,
mm-hmm.
One choosing a representation for the type as being T and another as T prime, both providing the same interface, I'd like to show that my program computes related results.
Yeah.
And do you think that would be possible to reconcile that view with this concrete view of?
Well, I think if you just rely on the typing that is done on the abstract terms, then the abstract terms are really not revealing the underlying representation. They don't even have it in some sense. They're operating on the abstract setting. So.
But to give meaning to that,
yeah.
you should relate them to their to the fact that these things are typed abstractly.
Yeah.
Should imply that the runs are related.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure like this, but I mean I imagine that these are almost separate concerns, right? Like this is only like a proof device here to solve
sure,
soundness,
yeah,
but
okay.
it's I'm not sure. I don't think it has any bearing on whether these.
So true sound is not necessarily abstraction. Is that a way to understand it?
Yeah, I think that's fair. Abstraction. Well, in some sense, we didn't abstraction is shown by the way you type the surface program, right? There you have abstraction. But
mm-hmm.
now, if you wanted to actually prove that you have abstraction, then I think you would need a technique like you just described,
okay.
and you would probably have a you would probably yeah have to deal with it differently. Okay, so let's see. So I guess the main takeaway from the retrospective on proving soundness is that at the end it was a happy journey in the sense that the sound calculus is simpler yet more regular, more powerful and expressive than the initial design. So a good proof is indeed one that makes us wiser, as Yuri Manin said. And otherwise, the things that we had is that there were quite a few techniques that we had to find out to do that. So in particular, the problem with bad bounds was that at the beginning, if we were trying to prevent them, then we also were making the static semantics not monotonic. But basically, once we embrace subsumption and not require precise calculations anymore, then things made more sense from the proof's point of view. Okay. So here are some the works on the dot calculus and some of the tools we've used, including Daphne at the beginning to explore the the soundness proofs, and we have mechanized proofs in Coq, in both small step and big step. Any questions on DOT before I move on?
So how do you tackle understanding how expressive you need to make your calculus? You know, make it very concrete. Is DOT capable of expressing everything that's required in the Scala compiler? Right? So yeah. There's a balance between the semantics you provide and mm-hmm. the expressivity.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, in the formalization itself, I mean, we haven't really like tried to really characterize what exactly we can express. I mean, we've tried, you know, to type check some pretty large examples and things like this. Anecdotally, Martin Odersky has been using the type system for the new compiler, and there he basically uses the types from the core calculus, and except for higher kind of types, it works quite nicely. For higher kind of types, he had some encodings that were not quite satisfying because they were leaky, and so now he's going more towards the direction of extension. But this is how it works. Any other questions?
Seems you moved through many systems as you formalize this stuff. Were you able to say extend existing developments as you know, or port them, or were they rewrites each time?
So the developments themselves are, I mean, you know, for like they're not that large, and basically for each variant we would have our own set of files. We didn't try to do a lot of proof engineering and a lot of proof sharing, but I mean the reason was that initially we used PLT Redex just to do more modeling, and then Daphne was actually useful to get sort of the big picture of like where we would get stuck in the proof, and then 12 was nice because we could do both proof checking and proofs and searching for examples in the same system. Eventually we settled on Coq, but I think it's because it was maybe the tool that worked best to do these incremental sorts of development. I mean, for example, Daphne worked really nicely at the beginning, and then once the development got too large, then the SMT solving would suddenly not work, and so it would be hard to fix the proof as the system scaled. But yeah, but I think this was mostly has to do with my collaborators as well, which tool they were more comfortable with. Okay. So any other questions? So now off to the second part, Spring Boot, generative programming and verification. So first, some more motivation. So as I said earlier, Scala fuses concepts from FP and OOP. And one example here is this matrix class, which is generic on the underlying type of the elements, though it has to be a numeric type, and then it defines times and plus on matrix by overloading these operations, so you can just use it this way. And so basically it's kind of like, yeah, sort of high level code using many features and all that. But now the question we can ask is, what about performance? And the wishful thinking is that the compiler or Java virtual machine will make it run fast, but the hard reality is that you get orders of magnitude slowdown. And while we saw that Scala makes it easy to go from a small program to a large program, it's much harder to evolve from a slow program to a fast program. And yeah?
So you're saying that if you were to rewrite the program, say Java engineers, you could be faster?
Well, if instead of using this, you were, imagine like you were writing it just with like, yeah, for loops and things like this, and just doing the operations of matrix multiplication instead of trying to give this nice sugar on top of it. Yeah. And basically you're paying the price of abstraction penalty, because if we look here, so for this numeric thing, we have the type class indirection, then we also have an indirection through this array field, and each of these four loops actually disaggregates into a for each method which takes a function. So you have these closures and megamorphic call sites, and you also have the indirection of looking up the matrix element in the array. Okay, so in general, what we see is that as abstraction in a program increases, or as we're using higher level programming language, then we also have to mind the gap to the low-level abstractions in the hardware, which are really still at the at a much lower level. And what we have then is that the general purpose compiler acts as a bottleneck between the programmer and the hardware. And what we would like instead is this sort of more high bandwidth communication between the programmer and the hardware, where we start with high level representations and then lower these into other representations and lower further. And at each level, we can do generic optimizations and level specific optimizations. So how do we get there? Well, it's well known that any problem in computer science can be solved by another level of indirection, except problems caused by too many levels of indirection. And often, performance problems are such exceptional problems caused by too many levels of indirection. But actually, what we'll do is use indirection to solve performance problems too, and we'll do it through staging.
Was that the suffix to the code also?
It was part of the code. It's less well known, actually, that it's part of the code. Yeah. So we'll use indirection to solve performance problems too, and the way we'll do it is through staging. So the idea of staging is to separate your program into multiple stages, usually two, let's say. And the first stage is actually a program generator, which when executed yields the second stage program. And now you need a way to distinguish between whether an expression belongs to the first stage or the second stage. And the way we do it in LMS, Lightweight Modular Staging, which is a framework in Scala, we do staging driven by types. So if an expression has type int string t, it means execute now during code generation. And if an expression has type rep of int, rep of string, rep of t, it means generate code to execute later. And so the way to think about it is that during code generation, you have access to the whole Scala language, but it's really sort of a glorified macro system to enable you to glue together these code fragments. And yeah?
Do these representation types work at arbitrary order and universe and so on? Like, can I have a representation for a polymorphic term?
Yeah, you can have a representation for a polymorphic term. But in general, what's available here is up to the way you use the library building blocks, or you can define your own, right? So you can mix in, say, the component that provides integers and operations of integers. I mean, think of rep as a completely abstract type, and then you have these operations on those rep types, which are really just like overloaded operations that you define exactly what they are, but the framework provides lots of them. So if you have a plus on two rep of ints, for example, then it will compute, like, it will, as a side effect, compute this this node, which this AST node with a plus, for example.
So if I have rep of the polymorphic identity function and I apply it to int, it will actually do a meta substitution on the type and give me.
So for functions, yeah, I mean, it depends. But for functions, you can choose to reify your functions or not, right? But if you have a rep of t, you can define the identity polymorphic function as something that goes from rep of t to rep of t. And then if you apply it to a rep of int, then that works. Any other questions? Okay, so if we go back at the matrix example, by just adding the things in red here, we turn the rep types, basically, we turn this program into a program generator. And here the idea is that the matrix class itself is purely during code generation, exists purely during code generations, but the underlying array is completely reified in the generated code. And so what happens is that all the code manipulation, all the operations that touch the underlying array will generate code. And so for this example, if we do a multiplication, then we get these low-level while loops code with manipulations on the array and everything. And already, just by doing this, we get a 20x speed up. But we could still even do more optimizations. And so here, we see an example of deep linguistic reuse, the idea that we can use during code generation all the power of the language, even though we don't pay the price in the generated code. And another programming pattern that I'm quite fond of is turning interpreters into compilers. So let's look at this next. So staging is a process that produces code, and an interpreter is something that takes code and additional input for this code and produces some result. And so if we put the two things together, we get a stage interpreter where we have code as input, and as output, we get code that is specialized to this particular input code. And the input to the interpreter, we make it symbolic, so that it's only in the second stage that we provide the actual input to get the result. So basically, we get a compiler. And to give an example, if we have a regular expression matcher, then the code would be the regular expression, and the symbolic input would be a rep of string, the expression we want to match again. But by making it a rep type, we make it symbolic. And so all the operations on this actual string input will be part of the generated code, but the regular expression itself will be specialized away, compiled away. And so when we give it an actual input, we get the result, a Boolean result of whether they match. Does this make sense to everyone? So this result that we can automatically turn interpreters into compilers is well known in the partial evaluation literature. What's different here is that the process is partly manual. The staging process is manual. And so we get full control over how we want to optimize things. And what we did is a SQL engine in 500 lines of code using this principle. So we start with a plain query interpreter, stage it to get a compiler. And then we do some specialization of data structures, in particular following a column store layout. So even though the interface is row store driven, we can do a column store layout underneath the abstractions. And then we also switch to a C backend and optimize I/O with memory mapping. And by doing all of this, we get a SQL engine that is 4 to 7 times faster than state-of-the-art database engines like Postgres. And the reason this works is that Postgres and other database vendors, they actually provide a SQL engine that is an interpreter, a generic interpreter, however sophisticated. And by doing compilation, we can beat that, of course. And so the way it works at a high level is that,
Do you have a compiler that takes the output and compiles it to C, or do you
do it by hand? The actual framework in Scala can generate a code for multiple backends. So it can generate Scala, but there's nothing special about generating Scala versus generating C. So it has all these different backends. So we just switched the backend.
Okay.
So here what we do is that we have this process CSV file where we specify a function to run on each record or each line of the file. And so here we say, okay, if the record flag is equal to yes, then print the record name. And this is how you would write this code in Scala. So it's not very many lines of code. And then on top of this, you can have a higher level processing where you start with a SQL query and transform it into this AST of linear algebra operators. And then you can write an interpreter for this AST. And also even you will have to write an evaluator for the predicate expression, like this for the filter clauses. And just by doing this, we basically can also now process things directly from queries. So this is just a small example to show how you would do the interpreter. And then now the question is, if you wanted to turn this, if you wanted to make this faster, then what you would do is you would make the fields themselves, you would make it a rep type, but the schema itself is known. And here we chose to, for this example, we chose to do a rep of array of string, but it would also be, you could also do array rep of string, where you actually know the array length because you assume that you know that the fields always have the same length. And this is actually what we do in the SQL engine, but for these slides here, I'm just putting the rep over all of this. And then if I'm inside the process CSV file, I can choose to do this run where I specialize this code to the schema and to the function that I'm running. So if I'm running it this way, then I would get the basically the record abstraction and schema indirection are gone. And so by specializing the whole execution where the AST itself, the operator itself would be known, we would also basically turn the interpreter into a compiler and get rid of all the overhead of parsing the actual AST of relational algebra operators. And then the other thing that this example shows is that you have these staging time functions, so functions that take rep and return rep, but are themselves only exist during staging time. So by default, these will just be inlined, but you can expect they basically just exist in the during code generation. So you, just by the type, you are guaranteed that this function will not exist in the generated code. And then for mixed stage data structures, so this record thing has this record class has fields that are symbolic, unknown at during code generation time, and schema that is known. And this is quite a common pattern as well. Okay, so moving on to a different example of efficient hand-optimized HTTP parsing. So here, this is a snippet of hand-optimized HTTP parsing looks like, where we basically have this sort of state machine-like code where we're in a certain state, and depending on the next character, we go to the next state. And an HTTP parser is 2,000 lines of such code, and this is taken from the parser that is originally part of Xing and later Node.js. And so it's very hard to change because of the low-level nature. And on the other hand, we can also start with a much higher-level parser written using parser combinators. So here we can say a response is a status followed by headers, and headers are a repetition of header, and then a header is a header name followed by a column followed by the rest of the line being the property and so on. And by doing this, we have about 200 lines of code, and it's fairly easy to change the behavior. And now by staging this parser combinator, we can generate low-level code that is fairly competitive with Xing. And this was done by Manohar Jonalageda and others at Uppsala 2014. So the basic idea of how this works is that the parser class actually extends the staging time, well, this function that takes a rep of input and returns this pass result, which also has these rep types inside of it. And so the whole composition of the parsers happen during code generation, and what you're left is low-level specialized code that manipulates this rep of input. And so this is great for performance, but what about security? And this is not a moot question, since there has been many security advisories for all major HTTP servers, so in particular related to chunked processing. And because of the chunk processing, you have to specify the size of your chunks, and you can get an integer signed error or a stack-based buffer overflow. And this allows remote attackers to execute arbitrary code. So our solution here is to do generative metaprogramming and verification. What this means is that as we're starting at a high level from the code generator, we can generate low-level code, but also low-level annotations that allow independent tools to verify the code. So in our case, we use Framasi on low-level C code, and we use as annotations this standard C specification language annotation, ACSL. And the bet is that because we start from a high level, we can actually generate these annotations without much tediousness, even though the low-level tools requires them to be quite precise to enable verification. So in the case of the HTTP parser, we basically just needed only a handful of annotations in the code generator, which expanded to many annotations in the generated code, and we were able to verify full memory safety and overflow safety. And in general, in this context, we found that type classes are particularly useful, especially for beyond safety, also considering functional correctness. So here is just an idea of how this works. So for example, you can have a type class for equality, a type class for transforming from a list of reps and back for transforming a data structure from a list of reps and backs, and this invariance on when a data structure is valid. And by instantiating this for a vector type, which consists of a pointer and a length, then say we instantiate equality over vector of rep of int, then we generate low-level code that here for vectors of integers, where we say that we can specify a predicate for when two vectors are equal, and this is part of the spec. And we can also specify, we can also generate some code and ensure that the code and the spec match. And all of this is generated from just this implicit ecvecvec of repavent. So we do it for vectors of integers and also for vectors of integers. And you see that automatically the representation of the vectors of integers, they match the, I mean, they depend on the type class as well. So here, this is how the representation compose. We basically exploded the fields. And so in summary here for generative program, for generative verification, so generative programming extends to verification when properties to verify fits the staging time abstractions. And this is why type classes are particularly useful, because they're well suited for composing and specializing specifications, as they provide a discipline for structuring genericity. And here the goal was to enlarge the success story of abstraction without regret of generative programming from high performance computing to also safety critical domains. And in summary, we were pleasantly surprised by how little work was required to go from working to verified, and from one instance verified to many, up to all wanted instances verified. And these are some works on generative programming that I was involved in, but the project has a broader, it's part of a larger group of projects and collaborations, in particular with the Light team at Stanford, which has been working on domain-specific languages and big data on heterogeneous device based on extensible compilers, and other teams as well at ETH and EPFL. Okay, so yeah, and on this website you can learn more about the lightweight modular staging framework. So in terms of conclusion and future directions, so for DOT, I mean, there would be a lot of future work in terms of extending DOT with other features, in particular higher kind of types, and also encoding code-sharing mechanisms and inheritance into DOT. So some people in the lab at EPFL and elsewhere are working on such extensions and encodings. And then I think one interesting question is bridging the gap from safety to correctness. So the work that F-star is doing with dependent types for actual correctness and verification, I think is very interesting in this space where you kind of have type systems, but they're not just for safety. And then in the context of staging, one interesting work to explore in the future is collapsing towers of interpreters. So going from just stage interpreter to compiler, to also collapse multiple level of interpretations, and you can do this through polymorphic staging. And yeah, more generally, I guess the idea here is to go meta. So in both cases, the underlying I was looking at underlying concepts or lenses to simplify thinking about a class of problem, and trying to abstract over a particular language. And in the future, I would like to explore new ways of programming via such ideas. Thank you.
Yep, time for questions.
Hello. Yes, that's good. So how does your work compare to earlier partial evaluation work like MetaML and some like examples you showed with SQL and web server? Would you have been able to do those in a language like MetaML, or do you rely on new features?
Yeah, so I mean, initially the multi-staging idea is based on the work like MetaML. I think here there's a few things. So here we're doing this sort of heterogeneous encoding, where we're in MetaML you're using these quotations, and then the language you're generating is also ML, right? It's the same. So it's called like homogeneous staging. Yeah. So in our case, we're doing really heterogeneous code generation in some sense, and this is also important for the work on verification, where we're generating annotations, specifications, which is kind of a completely different language of it on its own, right? So this is the main difference. And the other thing is, I guess we were able to do these larger scale examples because, the framework is a little bit batteries included in some sense. So we could actually use it to try some some larger examples, practical examples.
Yeah, I think the representations, mm-hmm. the programmer can supply those representations, I presume.
So it's completely user extensible, but the idea is that basically the rep type is completely abstract in the when you actually write your code again, but then the underlying representation is based on some AST nodes that even the user can choose.
So that means that the operations that you apply to those may have side effects that are not readily noticeable at the abstract level, right?
Well, if you want to actually work on the AST level, the side effects are also part of the AST. So you have to provide information about side effects. So for example, when you define a print node, you have to clearly specify that it has side effects. Well, if you define a plus node, it might not have side effects. And this is important to be able to do common sub-expression elimination and things like this.
I see. So it's the compiler that needs that information as well, not just the...
It's the framework, yeah.
So the AST is decorated with telling you that this print node has side effects?
Yeah, so you can think of effects as additional dependencies in the AST.
Does it tell you what effect it has, or just has that this is effectful?
So you can have a vague effect, like just saying it's effectful, and then it's serialized with respect to other such general effects, but you can have more fine-grained effects like read and write effects. And then this could be part of a, like you could even serialize more precisely in terms of which data structure is affected by the read or the write.
Ben,
how does
that
work? Yeah, actually, so the first question, I guess, is LMS being used large scale programming in Scala? I know Scala is being used a lot for, say,
yeah.
Spark and this kind of MapReduce paradigm. Is it used in that?
Well, so Thierry Cromp, who started LMS and is now at Purdue University, he has some work on a backend for Spark that uses LMS to accelerate things. In general, I would say it's more has been in research than in industry. But here, I mean, Huawei, for example, has been using it also in research and in an industrial setting, and there are some, it has been mostly in research, so maybe not as large scale as.
So let me ask a follow up question, because this reminds me, back about 10 years ago, even more, there was some interest in staging around the Singularity Project,
mm-hmm.
and Mike Carbon actually worked on this for a while.
Okay.
And before that, of course, Backquote and Lisp. I mean, this stuff has been around for mm-hmm. like 3 or 4 decades. I'm really curious. What do you think is the reason that it hasn't sort of gone mainstream? In the sense that there's a lot of people using programming language, functional languages, even.
Yeah.
But that particular dimension isn't doesn't seem like it's caught on. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I don't. So I mean, I do think that in practice, it's a little. Sometimes like mind blowing and hard to wrap your head around what's going on. So it's maybe that's one reason. Yeah, but as a principle to do code generation, I think it's quite nice. Like the principles are very elegant and conceptually it makes a lot of sense. In practice, you run into all sorts of issues. And I mean, like you call a function recursively, and then you just by doing this, like you blow up your code generation. So there's a lot of things that makes it maybe a very sharp tool. I think that might be one reason, or it might also be that we're not there yet, functional programming took a long time to become mainstream, so maybe it's the same for staging and other principled code generation techniques. I'm not sure.
JavaScript evals is sadly very widely used.
Yeah, but I'm not sure if I would call that principled code generation.
I think you pointed out, the recursive function
mm-hmm.
is deeply troublesome in practice. For doing this kind of stuff in general, right? So I think it means that it's very easy to write a program where your generated code explodes, or where you have to be really careful about what you will rep and what is static.
Yeah.
And if you make a mistake there, you get very you know, code explosion or results that you really weren't expecting.
Yep.
I think it's very hard to give the right feedback to the user or to see that. So I was hoping you would go into that more. Like now you show like the success
story. Yeah, no, I don't really
have.
You
don't show the pain, maybe.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean,
all the way.
I agree that it's not super easy to wrap your head around it. Yeah, I agree. And I'm not sure the tools are very good. I mean, right now the problem is that, well, here we're kind of piggybacking on the Scala type system to do the heavy lifting of the binding time inference and checking, right? So that means when you get an error because you don't have the right stages, then you get a type error. And sometimes it can be confusing, but oftentimes it's not that that difficult to understand. So yeah, I agree. I think I agree with everything you said.
Maybe also, like you said, oh, mm-hmm. the schema is not a red, for example.
Yeah.
But what would happen if I make it red?
Ah, okay. Well, I mean, if you make it red, then what are you specializing? What are you specializing then? Like, if everything is red, then you would. And in some cases, it's just a question if you make it trap, then you will basically just not generate optimal code, right? And
right. So, you know, you're delaying.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think that's maybe what Ben was after. I think that's where maybe part of the problem lies. Like, you have to be quite an expert to know where to put it, right? And then Scala helps a lot.
Yeah.
By checking, time checking.
Yeah, but I think that's true, though. In this case, I think in general, you do have a high-level view of what you're trying to achieve, right? And especially if you take this interpreter-to-compiler pattern, then it makes it much clearer, okay, well, I mean, this part of the interpreter I know and I want to specialize against and things like this. So you have principles to think about it. But it's true that it's a sharp tool.
Does it work out of the box these days? Because I feel like, I mean, I could be wrong. It's been a couple years since I read the original paper, but like in 2014, I thought like TRC had a patch version of the compiler. Do you still need a patch version of the compiler?
So now there's also a macro-based system, which so there both systems are available and for some, I mean, but yeah, so you don't need a patch anymore, but you need a way to virtualize the language because you want to be able to say if you have an if expression, you want to be able to use if and then have a rep of Boolean as opposed to a Boolean, and then this if becomes part of the generated code.
So by using the macros, do I just lose out on some syntactic sugar?
No, you don't. So with macros, you can get the full virtualization of control structures. I think there are some issues with the only thing that you might lose out. You're right. It's some syntactic sugar with the infix methods.
Yeah.
It's not quite. It doesn't work quite as well for some.
Right, because then people are relying on like method macros with white space in order to get the syntactic sugar in Scala, like with control structures and stuff. Sort of the way that people were implementing break and other weird control structures before.
I'm not sure about the white space. I'm not sure what you're.
I guess I'm just asking how you get, because you know, like writing if, like,
mm-hmm.
you know, you require very particular parentheses and white spacing and brackets. The same like syntactic look.
I think it's fine. The
okay.
if is fine. Did you have a question, Mr.?
Right. When you translate levels down, one can imagine there would be a lot of runtime checks that are added for the array, for example, array bounds checks, and then you go to the next level, which maybe may introduce its own bounds and so forth. But you know that all the bounds would hold just because of the way that the translation is. What happens with those during the compilation phases?
Well, we don't insert array checks at all.
Okay, so they're just not there. I mean,
yeah,
so
yeah.
the programmer is...
So usually when you go from Scala to Scala, that's not an issue because you...
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
And then if you go to C, then yeah, it's the programmer is on its own, which is why, well, with the verification project, we try to statically prove that it's that we won't get such errors, right?
Can I still have a question?
Of course.
Too much? Or?
No, go for it.
So I really like your work on Dot. I think
mm-hmm.
really cool stuff. And so in the Dot language that you show, there's no crawl like quantifiers. like for all alpha to alpha types.
Yeah, well, they're hidden somewhere. I mean,
right. So you do everything through these path dependent types. So
yeah.
I wondered, is there like a type directed translation from any system F program into DOLS?
Definitely, yeah.
Definitely. So
yeah.
So how would you do like identity function like for all alpha, alpha to alpha? You would have to pass a particular evidence, right? Like a trait.
Yeah. So
that contains the alpha member.
Yeah, so think so you would so for all alpha will be basically sorry, I'm trying to find.
So I was thinking every alpha turn for all alpha turns into an explicit parameter.
Yeah, exactly.
Of the evidence that type exists, right?
Yeah, so the for all alpha will turn into basically one of these, a type member. L from bottom to top.
Right, so it become
then,
like every type application would actually become a value
application a value,
of a trait that contains the type information.
Yeah, so it becomes a value application like this a store location, but really one of these where you have this information.
Right, and that's how you would do it to qualify types too, then there would be bounds in there.
Yeah, so you can do it, and it does rely on the fact that you have these dependent methods, right? So that the return type can depend on the parameter type. It's very important for the transition.
That's very elegant. Great.
Okay.
Well, let's thank the other thing.